Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
And it's 2016, and we're here in Mompox, Colombia, with Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall, your host, and welcome back. Yes, we've taken a few weeks off. I think everyone deserves a few weeks off over Christmas and New Year, and indeed it was a great period of the year here. And I'm calling you and I'm reporting in from Mompox, Colombia, so where some of you will know that I have my little hotel, the Casa Amarilla, here, and I've been spending with my family. You know, it's a very nice downtime. Well, downtime you'd say, but we're running the hotel through the high season. So it has been fun, but it's always fun to receive guests and it's always fun to receive friends. And of course, family members too, who come out. And my stepmother came all the way from San Diego, California this time. So that was very special. So yes, it's been a momentous, end of the year. First year, of course, with my son, James, born on the Bogotazo, the 9th of April. And indeed, here in Mompox, there have been all sorts of goings on. But I want to do a quick shout out to Monica and Richard. I think they're Dutch tourists who stopped me in the street here in Mompox and came to the town because they'd been listening to this podcast. So anyways, a quick shout out to you who obviously saw my dog running ahead of me here in the town and knew that it was me because of Monty the Weimaraner, and stopped to say hello, and listeners of this podcast. And it's always great to hear from people like you and to you know, share a couple of words, because if we can keep the good news coming out of Colombia, we can keep on bringing people to these exciting and off the beaten track destinations and to better understand a much misunderstood country such as Colombia. And of course, that's part of what we try to do here on Colombia Calling, is untangle a little bit more, untangle in as much as we can some of the complexities about Colombia. And at the same time, it doesn't seem so complex, and then it does seem so complex. And those of you who know Colombia will understand my sort of my tangle of words on that. But that's the truth about it, is that, you know, sometimes it just seems so straightforward what needs to be done here, and then the other times you come up against everything. But rather than wax lyrical and go off on a digression about that, I want to talk. I've got a long list of things to talk about today, because I think that this episode one for 2016, or episode 124 in total, I think it should be, you know, a summary of what happened in 2015 and what we expect for 2016 here in Colombia. And I think there's not, you know, obviously I can't cover everything, and especially in 40 minutes, because it would take forever. But at the same time, you know, it's for us to sit back and to think about, where do we feel that Colombia is heading in 2016 and beyond? And it's an interesting situation because, of course, the geopolitics related to everything out here and, of course, across the world. So let's you know, put our heads together and think about this. And I would love to hear from any of you out there thinking about where Colombia will go in 2016. And of course, you can get in touch through our website. That's www.columbiacallingradio.com. And of course, our emails, columbiacalling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter at Columbia Calling and via the Facebook page, where I do post almost anything going on about Colombia, good or bad, and indeed promote those people who have been on our show and what they have been up to, so you can stay abreast and in the know of what has been going on with these fantastic people and people, you know, really doing things here in Colombia or things elsewhere that are directly affecting Colombia, Colombians abroad, and so on and so forth, you know, spreading the good word about this great country. So I'm going to take a short break right now, and I'll be back with a summary and a conversation about things about 2015 and 2016. Any noise you hear is a merciful breeze blowing through my office here in Mompos, where it's currently around 40 degrees. And any hammering in the background is the repairs. Are there repairs taking place on the belfry of the Concepcion Church alongside us? So pretty exciting, pretty nice stuff going on. You can picture the tropics. When you think of me sitting here, you know, we've got those heavy-leaved banana trees and bougainvillea with their bright flaming colors, and the pool in the background, which I'll probably take a dip in the afternoon. It's not a hard life here, you know, for me at this moment. It's pretty enviable. But I guess with the next show, I'll be back in Bogota, back at the Daily Grind, and more about that in the next section of this episode 124 on Colombia Calling. I'll be right back. Please stay listening. And here we are back again, Colombia Calling 2016, first episode of the year, episode 124. That's I feel quite proud. You know, there were some moments last year where I was considering shutting down Colombia Calling, and there were some issues, personal and professional, that felt that I think I've done enough. But with, you know, run-ins with people, obviously positive run-ins, let's say, people stopping me in the street and saying, you know, we are listeners, or people, you know, emailing me, this kept me going, and it you know, it helps us strive for better, to get, you know, bigger and better, not necessarily bigger and better, just better quality content, better interviews, better people. And so I'm trying, you know, we're trying to get people here on the show to talk about things. And I'm sure in this next year, 2016, I'll have many more people lined up for interviews. I know I've got in the pipeline with Erin Donaldson, who's the open-minded traveler, who will be on the show at some point. I'm sure we'll have some real estate gurus talking to us at some point, travel people, political people, so on and so forth. And very interestingly, I'm starting a doctorate, a PhD here in Bogota. Well, I'm in Mompos, but when I head back to Bogota, I'll be starting a PhD. And I'm sure with the studies into that and my own, love for investigation, my thirst for knowledge about the center of Bogota, which will be part of my thesis, I will be put into contact with more people whom I can then interview. So hopefully some of those who I've been contacting over the past, over a year now, will come good. We won't flake out on me, and we'll get some good interviews ahead for you to listen to. And so 124 episodes, I think that's worth a nice little pat on the back. And also, it would be nothing without you listeners out there. So again, thank you so much. Quick note of events. It's very exciting to always hear back from former interviewees, and indeed people of, of importance, because some of you will know that back in the day, we interviewed Tom Feiling, the author of Short Walks from Bogota, The Candy Machine, which is the story of the cocaine trade. Anyway, I received an email from him this morning, in fact, and he was talking to me about his book on Providence, or as we know it, Providencia, in Colombia, the Colombian island, which is closer to Nicaragua. Anyway, he was researching it in 2013 and 2014, and after 2.5 years of writing and research, the book has been written. The title is, but to be confirmed, but the title at the moment is The Island That Disappeared, Puritans, Pirates, and Old Providence. And it will be It will be published in the UK and other Commonwealth countries by Explore Books, November 2016. So keep an eye out for November 2016, this book, which, you know, the island has disappeared. It's a dramatic retelling of how a small island in the Caribbean became the focus for England's first attempts at colony building in the years leading up to the English Civil War. Old Providence was first settled in 1630 as a refuge for persecuted Puritans. Their sponsors envisaged the island as a base for a future English empire to be built in Central America, but the colony soon became a pirate's lair and the settlers were expelled by the Spanish in 1641. After being abandoned for over 100 years, the island was resettled by Englishmen and their African slaves, whose descendants have been wrestling over the legacy of the island's Puritans and pirates ever since. Though long forgotten in Britain, Old Providence is a microcosm of 400 years of colonial history and offers precious insights into religious fervor, race, and the culture of discipline in both Britain and the Caribbean. So, you know, you can look up the website. That's www.oldprovidenceisland.com. That's Tom Filing's website about the island. But I can tell you, it's a pretty special book. Very excited that that's coming out. And we are thrilled to have had Tom Filing, an author of, you know, very high editorial quality here on this show. So look back through our archives and you can find that show and get yourself up to speed. Let's say, get yourself up to speed on that book. But it's for November anyway. So it's November 2016. So keep an eye out in the press for that. Now, aside from that, what do I want to say? Well, we'll go back a little bit about 2015. I know we're well into 2016 now, but a little bit about 2016. But of course, what would you say are the most important things to have taken place in Colombia in 2015? Well, of course, it's the continuance of the peace talks, the peace dialogues between the FARC, so the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia, so the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, and the Colombian government, so led by Humberto de la Calle and Sergio Jaramillo and others. And of course, how far they've come, you know, how far they've come, how far they will go. And hopefully in March 2016, there will be a progression towards a signing of a final peace agreement, you know, how to end the conflict. So this is possibly one of the trickiest points, but I think we've gone past the point of no return. Now I think we can say that we've gone past the point of no return because we've got past the justice point. We don't really know fully what has been agreed because it will all be released at once, I think probably to flood the airwaves with information. But at the same time, there's been a great deal of progress. And now this is the first real peace accord to have been agreed since the Statute of Rome has been brought in back a few years ago. So it's the first one that will apply these sort of new qualities from the International Criminal Court towards the justice to be brought up against the FARC and members of the military and members of perhaps the armed, when we say military armed forces, and of course paramilitary groups. And I guess that's really what the FARC guerrillas are, pushing for. They're pushing for the fact that they are not the only ones to have suffered. Of course, they always put themselves out there as having been the first victims of the conflict. Now, as a negotiator, you cannot allow them to believe that they are the first victims of the conflict, because then that gives them the right to almost anything. It gives them the moral high ground from the top. But there's an interesting divergence of events, because I've been reading a book called How to Negotiate with Terrorists by a very very qualified man who's been involved in everything, every peace talk that's been going on since day one, let's say. Anyway, he says that more of these sort of belligerent groups can no longer compete with the willingness for bloodshed and murder and heinous atrocities. People like the FARC and the ELN and whomever cannot compete with the, let's say, groups like ISIS out in the east. Now, I know I'm treading on dangerous ground here saying this, but they can't compete with that. And so they're falling into a lack of sort of recognition and a lack of importance on this level. So very interesting to think of it from that level. It's like, you know, the FARC, for all of their heinous activities and all the atrocities that they committed, are falling into an insignificance internationally alongside these more blood, blood-curdling events coming out of Iraq, coming out of Syria, coming out of that region, you know, the region that we are all very worried about. And of course, then the people being, let's say, indoctrinated and coming back to Europe. So it's an interesting situation when we think of the FARC. I mean, if we put them alongside these people being beheaded, journalists being beheaded, aid workers being beheaded, they really seem kind of tame. But of course, this is not to take away from the 50-odd years of atrocities that have been committed. So interesting times, and we should be reading more. We should be reading more about these events, and of course the peace talks and the dialogues. And, you know, fingers crossed that things will still move ahead. I doubt that in March the final agreement will be signed, although President Santos, we can imagine, will be pushing for this as much as he possibly can, because he's staked his whole political legacy on this. Of course, in 2015, there were hiccups, the bombing in Rio Sucio, killing some guerrillas up there. Of course, the realization that the FARC themselves killed the Danish or the Swedish backpacker Jan Brownish up there as well, because he was in possession of a GPS, not because they wanted it, but because he was in possession of a GPS and trying to cross, you know, a notoriously dangerous area. So we have to think about the realities of this. But the fact that the FARC went out to Bohaya, where one of the greatest, most recent atrocities took place, where the cylinder bombs fired by the FARC landed on the church where the local people were hiding, killing dozens of people. I mean, truly, women and children, civilians, etc., etc. But members of the FARC went out there to ask for forgiveness, and it was a public display of their recognition of guilt. This is a big step, because if you study the other conflicts and peace dialogues and peace accords, if you study Argentina, South Africa, you study elsewhere, there have to be public displays of recognition and admission of guilt and a willingness for non-repetition. These are the key points to any conflict resolution. So what will be the outcomes for Colombia if the FARC sign up to a final peace agreement next year? This year, 2016. Well, don't expect too much to change too quickly. I mean, you know, the very fact that peace will be in the headlines of the international press is good news for Colombia. It's finally good news. But then, as always, as we start to write further, more investigative pieces about the realities of this, you know that it's going to take longer. I mean, this is going to take several generations to get, if not more, to get this hate, to get ingrained hate out of, you know, the genetics of Colombia. But as you know, and as President Santos continually harps on about, and any opportunity, especially when he's talking to international investors and multinational companies, peace means more investment. But we want to know who will be investing, because it needs to be, call me, you know, a lily-livered left-wing pinko liberal or something like that, but it needs to be the right investment for Colombia, because you're starting on almost what is a blank slate. A clean sheet, you know, you need to get things right. You can look at other countries and the way that they have progressed after peace dialogues and say, this is not how we want to progress. Colombia has natural resources. Colombia has beautiful virgin forest. Colombia has everything, the two coastlines and everything that every tourist board here, you know, really does scream from the towers at us. But it needs to be the right one, because we've got a great opportunity in a mega diverse country here to protect it, to make it the right investment. But I wonder if President Santos's government is in line for that. And I worry about that somewhat. You know, I don't suggest that he's not. I suggest that he knows exactly what's going on. But what will be better for Colombia, and especially in the socio-political, socio-economic and geopolitical situations of today, of 2016. Remember what it is. Remember what's going on. The price of petrol, which of course, you know, Colombia is completely dependent on this, completely dependent, and it's been a real kick in the teeth to the national coffer, the national purse strings. There just isn't the money to pay for everything that has been promised, and not least a post-conflict period. And remember, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, violence increases as soon as a peace accord is signed. And of course, a peace accord with the FARC, it does not mean peace in Colombia. So these are couple of things that are never really largely spoken about in the international press, but a peace accord with the FARC does not mean peace. There is the ELN as well, the Ejército de Liberación Nacional, the National Liberation Army, which arguably are better positioned than the FARC in areas for legal and illegal mining and along the borders and in strategic corridors. So they know where they can hit the economy hardest, especially for multinational mining firms, Canadian, Australian, British, whomever. Those mining firms are the ones who have been sold, let's say, reasonably priced lots in which to explore and exploit by the government to get those international, to get the hard currency into the country. Because when we talk about hard currency, Colombia's peso is about the most devalued currency, or the third most devalued currency in the world last year. And it's now up to, I think the dollar at the moment in January is at 3,400 or 3,200 pesos, which is pretty, something's going to need to be done with interest rates. I'm no economist. I don't deign to explain the situation. And those of you out there listening will clearly know more than me. If you're an Englishman, now is the time to come to Colombia, because it's almost 5,000 pesos to the pound. That really is quite a benefit to you. Colombia is suddenly a very reasonable place in which to travel. So leaving those things out, thinking about the realities of a potential agreement signed, a final agreement in March, we're going to take a short break and be back and discuss this further. But I hope you're enjoying Colombia Calling, episode 124, and we'll be right back to speak further about these issues. Thank you, and don't go away. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Mompós, Bolívar. So way up northern Colombia, the Caribbean coast, but not exactly on the coast, because we're 5 hours inland from Cartagena, Santa Marta, and all of those areas. But I'm in my house here, not the hotel. I've been running the hotel this season. And yes, you can hear the motorcycles in the background, the ubiquitous sound of the Colombian coast or the Colombian pueblo. Everywhere you go, because you can buy motorcycles now just paying in installments on your electricity bill. So everybody's got access to a motorcycle. And there you go again, another motorcycle. So what can you do? Nothing really. Just watch out and not get hit by them, I suppose. But I've never seen a high season like this one here. Here in Mompós, so many people have come, and we've been turning away customers left, right, and center. And indeed, we've been putting people on a wait list to stay. So if we get a cancellation, we can call them up directly. I mean, pretty incredible stuff for a little town like Mompós in the middle of nowhere. It's been pretty special all in all. And of course, because I'm recording, there happens to be more motorcycles than ever. But never mind that. Now they've gone. So I was talking earlier about the consequences of maybe a peace accord in Colombia between the FARC and the government. And so we're talking a little bit about it, but of course, and I did mention, and I have mentioned before, and I'll mention again, that violence will increase post any peace accord being signed. But first of all, you've got the big question of what to do with former combatants, and what do they want to do, and what are they expecting from peace? A lot of them, let's say the rank and file, the guys from the countryside, just want a lot of land. But of course, it would be arrogant of me to suggest that that's all. People have taken up arms and taken up the struggle because of the injustices and the lack of social mobility and economic mobility available in this country. And of course, much of that completely stagnated here in the country because of the systems, the political and the economic systems. So they're looking for communication, and they're looking for education and for health. So how can the country get these things? How can it bring it together? And with the increase in interest rates, and probably the increase in VAT here in Colombia, and that the minimum wage has only been increased by 45,000 pesos. So we're not even talking about That's £9 a month, so roughly. So about, you know, $15 a month at the moment. That's what it's been increased by, which at the rate of cost, you know, your buying potential here is not a lot. And this leads to social unrest and social problems. So again, you feel like the government, while playing the fiddle ably in one corner with the FARC, is playing a different tune in another, because it's about economics, isn't it, at the end? And it's about land. So when you think about it, how are they going to get themselves out of this difficult situation? It remains to be seen. It's a tough one, you know. It remains to be seen how this can be improved. You know, at with £9 extra a month for, let's say, a five-person family where only one person actually works full-time, getting the minimum wage, if that, because in the pueblos, people don't get the minimum wage, maybe just in formal employment in the city. It's a tough one. It's a very tough call. So, can tourism pick up the slack? I doubt it. But we have to give a hat tip towards tourism, because Colombia is the sleeping giant of ecotourism. It will be a major ecotourism place. But of course, some of the most perfect places to visit are still off limits and will still be off limits as soon as a peace accord is signed. Los Catios National Park, the one that's up there by the Darien Gap, which is virgin rainforest, but is known for being controlled by the you know, various armed groups, not necessarily guerrillas, more banditry. So, you know, you won't be able to get into that one. You won't be able to go down into the Nucac Reserve. You won't be able to go into the one near to Popayan. These are all still in major, let's say, strategic areas for the transportation of drugs and arms. And of course, in people trafficking now as well. Probably they will pop up as well, being in synthetic drug, shelters. So it's a tough one to say. The government is gambling a lot on tourism, but with the issues in Europe, and we shouldn't be taking positives of this from this, you know, with things like ISIS and the attacks in Paris and proposed attacks in Rome and London and beyond, people will turn their way and look for other destinations, you know, where to travel. And of course, Latin America, South America will come into that. And it's a kind of ironic that Colombia, with a conflict of over 50 years, will come into their, you know, to their reckonings of being a safe place to visit. Now, of course, you know, this will be positive for Colombia. But while Europeans may come, what I worry about is that North Americans may stop traveling altogether, because they've got, you know, 40 different countries in one. So they might stop international travel. There will certainly be a reduction in travel to Europe by North Americans. That's the truth. Those who've already paid for their packages will go. But those who are considering it, who have been sitting on the sidelines and on the fence about doing so, will, you know, they will think twice. And so Costa Rica will, of course, get more. Guatemala will, of course, get more. Mexico, being the neighbor, will, of course, get more. But can Colombia tap into this market a bit more? I don't know. Maybe we'll get more Canadians. Who knows? Maybe if the Canadians have an incredibly bad winter, they'll be down here again, like a few years ago when we were getting people from as far adrift as Fort McMurray, Alberta. I mean, it was amazing to get people from so far up there, where, in fact, my nephew works as a operating heavy machinery. So it you know, while the government gambles on tourism, we have to also push the tourism, but also at the same time, is the infrastructure up to a state to be able to accommodate this tourism? And I would say no, we're getting there. It's a slow process. This has been, you know, divorced from international tourism for so long. It's only been in the last 8 years that really tourism has been picking up here. And I guess we're coming to somewhere near 4 million tourists a year. But of course, that's nothing like Quintana Roo in Mexico, which is more than 20 million tourists of just one state. But of course, that's beaches and packages and cheap flights. That's the truth. So it's a tough one to call. So I guess we'll kind of end up wondering, you know, what will have been, and reflecting on this moment, reflecting on why things might have been, or what might have been, what might happen, and so on. But Colombia, there is a bright future. We have to think about it as being a bright future. Yes, but the only way forward The only way to pick up the slack, as I see it, is that we have to eradicate a further few percentage points of the corruption across the country. You know, it's not so much tourism that's going to pick up the slack. It's not so much that an upsurge in the cost of petroleum, of course, will help Colombia. But at the same time, it's just not everything. The institutionalized corruption in the country is something that needs to be addressed quite seriously. And, you know, President Santos, of course, talked all about that in his first inauguration, his first term as president. But the reports are coming out saying that this government is potentially more corrupt than the last. Now, I find it harder to believe, because if more businesses are becoming formal and more people are in formal employment, and there's a more of a paper trail, more of a record. But you never know where the press stands. Well, the press stands in favor of the president because of his links to the press and so on. But you never really know what is the negotiating factor and the mitigating factor behind these articles, really, until well after the event itself. It's a tough one. So we've talked about oil prices, we've talked about tourism, but what will I say? The investment will increase with just the very word peace in headlines in Colombia. Investment, but what kind of investment? We haven't discussed that, and I don't have the answer to that, because, of course, with the rush for natural commodities, it will be the mining companies who come and are looking for cheap land. It'll be them first before the next investment. And what else are we hoping to happen in 2016? Well, after more than 17 months of clandestine talks in Ecuador and in Brazil, we can hope that the ELN will have come to their senses and perhaps be ready, let's say, for dialogues. Who knows where they'll do it? Possibly Ecuador, possibly Brazil. But let's hope that this is the year, 2016, that the National Liberation Army also say, we want to sit down and talk. But the problem is, one gets the feeling that they aren't keen on peace. That's not to say they want war. It's to say that they benefit more from a state of insurgency than they would own a state of peace. Now, that's an interesting concept and perhaps a little bit controversial, but I would say it's true. You know, they get their money from trafficking, of course, or charging a protection fee on traffickers, or a percentage of that sold, or a percentage of that being moved, and of course arms dealing and so on, and of course percentages on mining, both legal and illegal. But so, and I just think, you know, it's much harder, as texts and academics will tell you, to negotiate with a guerrilla group who does everything by committee. Whereas in, you know, the FARC, you've got Timochenko, Timoleon Jimenez Echeverri. He is the top guy. The buck stops with him. So you have a chain of command, and you've got Ivan Marquez and Jesus Santrich and Andres Paris and all the rest of them who are, you know, the secretariat. But you've got a pyramid structure. But in the ELN, you've got, I don't remember how many they are, all of the same, you know. I know you've got Gabino up top, but they're all more or less of the same rank, and they take all decisions as a committee. Now, it's very difficult indeed to negotiate with a committee, and it's a different type of negotiating altogether. But maybe 2016 can be the year. Perhaps they've reached, I doubt it will be 6 points or 5 points like with the FARC, with subsections. It will be many more, because the ELN are more complex in this situation. But the more you can get them down to, the better chance it has, because you can actually, you know, really end up truly discussing the issues. You know, when we would talk about Caguan back in 1998 to 2002, the Andres Pastrana peace dialogue failure, San Vicente de Caguan, the FARC had some sort of 200 things on their list, and one of them was to eradicate capitalism and eradicate poverty, which, you know, it's all well and good on paper, but just that's not the way the market works. That's not the way the world works. I said, you can study anywhere on this one. And you know, the FARC were taken off to Norway as well to talk to people, and they end up buying all sorts of gadgets and themselves being corrupted over there. But when they came back, the other leaders took all of their belongings that they had purchased overseas and burnt them so as not to corrupt any of the others. I mean, there's some very interesting snippets of information coming out about those previous peace talks, which were probably buried at the time so as not to give people further information about the nature of these groups. But I do think this will be the year, 2016, and I guess best the bet that the president is is banking on it too. Do we expect March 2016, the final agreement, to be signed? My logic says no. But if the president has his way and pushes it through, then so be it. So be it. But of course, like I learned in the conflict resolution, that needs to be on a key date, like the Good Friday Agreement with the IRA. There's a key date that's important to everyone. Then therefore, it'll be recognized by everyone. So it won't be like March 23rd. Well, what is March 23rd? It would make more sense in Colombian terms to say April 9th, we'll sign the peace. Now, April 9th, of course, as you know, is the Bogotazo, the date of the Bogotazo from 1948, when Bogota, parts of central Bogota, were razed to the ground with the assassination, following the assassination of Elisa Gaitan, the liberal leader, who was shot downtown pretty much on Avenida Jimenez with Carrera Septima. There are a lot of plaques there, so if you're visiting Bogota, you can see it. There was a McDonald's on the corner. I'm not entirely sure if the McDonald's is still there now. I kind of hope it's gone. There's something a bit more, erudite or left bank there. But there was a McDonald's, and next door to the McDonald's, there were all sorts of plaques. Now, the Bogotazo occurred after this point, sure. But it was the spark. It was a spark of the discontent and the lack of trust between each side in Colombia, between each side, the liberals, the conservatives, Protestants and Catholics. And it is true that parts of the conflict in areas, rural areas of Tolima and Huila, started between Protestants and Catholics, landowners and peasants. So that was the spark for 1948 and the problems in and out of that. And in the later, into the 50s, these guerrilla groups formed out of, you know, communist sympathizers and so on. There was money from the Soviet Union and beyond. And of course, it's the power games and the power play of the Cold War. So it's a tough one to call. It's a tough one to call. But if they wanted to find a significant date that all conflict resolution and conflict negotiators would have you believe, and it's true, that a significant date that can be remembered by everyone upon which to have a peace accord signed, it would be the 9th of April. So you heard it here first. Anyway, and then after that, maybe, you know, it could be later on is the day that Colombia declares its independence from Spain or so on. But that would drag on. I mean, that's going on further into the year, and we can't have that either. So I'm going to close that sort of section of it about what I expect, you know. And of course, it was always going to be about peace. It was always going to be these talks because that's the most pressing thing, and that and the economy, and they're inherently linked. And just sort of wind down this show, the last 10 minutes, talking about the Monpos here, because I've been here for the last month, and of course, you know, this is the first episode of the year, and we've had a few weeks off, and it's been very nice to relax. What has been going on here, and some of you who follow my blog, richardmccoll.com, will notice that we've been strafed by El Nino here in Colombia, and there hasn't been any proper rain, and the rivers are running dry. And that's, you know, Monpos is no stranger to this either, because our river has dropped, I mean, just more than I've ever seen it drop before. The beaches have appeared in the center of the Brazo de Monpos, which was formerly the Magdalena River before excessive cattle farming further north, you know, changed the river's direction around an island, and then this part of the river got silted up. So we are hoping that this year, with the dredging of the river, I think there's a Dutch company behind it, that this will start to help us with the movement and the fluvial transport. But the river has dropped so low that even the emergency tubes that have been put in by Monpos's new mayor don't reach enough to be able to give water to the local population. And from the 18th of December to the beginning of the year, Monpos had no water in the mains. So people were going down to the riverbanks with, jerry cans and filling them up. And now each jerry can cost 5,000 pesos with river water in it, and to bring it to your house on a motorcycle cost a further 1,000 pesos. So if we think about the minimum wage being 600 and something thousand, you're spending 6,000 on a jerry can of water from the river for your needs, washing your dishes, washing your clothes, bathing yourself. you can start to tell that things are getting pretty difficult. Now, why did we have such a shortage here? Well, not only El Nino, it hasn't rained for months, and the rivers in the interior and the rivers are running dry, and there's no, let's say, plan put in place. There's no contingency plan. The dams are dry, so on and so forth. So the hydroelectric power, which is powering our electricity system in this area, of course, there's no water powering going through the dams to power the generators, to power the grid. And of course, so electricity prices have gone up because it costs them more to produce electricity. That's fine. Electrocaribe, being the biggest crooks on the Caribbean coast, have raised their prices by 40%. I mean, you know, not 1%, not 3%, 40%, and that will go up again. And they, the people in charge of the water company here in Mompos didn't pay their electricity bill. So their electricity was cut off. And so therefore, the treatment and the pipes could no longer work. So we had a condition, you know, a chain event of reactions, the chain reactions. You know, electricity prices go up. Water company doesn't pay electricity bills. Electricity gets cut off. Water company can no longer provide water. Town suffers. El Nino continues. Water continues to drop. Prices continue to climb. Still no water. So that's the situation. Very difficult for us to manage it. Very difficult to get out of it. We do have a new political family in power now, because all of Colombia went to the polls in October 2015 for local elections. So we now have Nubia, the mayoress of Mompos. Let's see what she has, you know, has to give this town. Let's see what she can offer this town in the way of just an improvement in life. So we'll see how that goes. And we wonder if it's going to be another sort of bought mayoralty, which will just increase an incidence of bizarre contracts being gifted out to different construction firms. So that's the Mompos story. But despite everything, in the Casa Maria, in my own house, we have put in 60-meter wells. So we have pumps put on those to fill up our water tanks. We may have a shortage of water, but we always have water. So that's something. And we filter all of our water. But of course, that's not open to everyone. It's not an option for everyone. You know, with the, I put the money aside after some income, and then, you know, we invest. But that, you know, not everyone can do that at all. So from here, where do we go? Well, I don't know. Back to Bogota, back to the blitz of Bogota, and to a new apartment and to new adventures, because I will be taking up my pen and paper and beginning a doctorate later on this month, later on in January. So around January the 20th, you may not hear from me, because I'll be starting a doctorate in social and human sciences, with my thesis based on investigating and establishing some of the reasons behind the decadence of central Bogota, focusing directly on the Barrio of Los Mártires, which is the barrio exactly directly west of the Plaza de Bolívar and La Candelaria. It's a very historic expansionist barrio, but beautiful buildings, but of course home to some of the most down and out major sites of addiction, prostitution, and everything else. But I want to do a proper investigation into this as a study into how society has developed in Bogota around that. Why is it that two blocks from the presidential palace we have this? We have such misery. And it didn't start in 1948. It started prior to 1948 and prior to the Bogotazo. It was already in play. That's the idea behind my thesis, which has been accepted to be written. So the idea is over the next 3 years to write, investigate and write a book about central Bogota and the history with regards to not only the politics, but the decadence and the misery. And of course, it will be about architecture and geography and urbanistic studies. And that's the truth of it. So looking forward to that very much. And what more can I tell you? That's about it really for me this week. And so we'll wind down the show and say thank you again for listening. Episode 124, episode one of 2016. I hope you found it interesting. Stream of narrative conscience here on my terrace with the motorcycles running beneath me here in Mompos, but you know, adding to the ambience of a recording. And from here on in, we'll be back in Bogota for a while, and then hopefully some travels around the country too, and talking to people from different areas around the country to get you a better image of what's going on in Colombia and what might be the future for this wonderful country that I am proud to call home. So get in touch through ColombiaCalling@gmail.com, ColombiaCallingRadio.com, and Twitter and Facebook. I've been Richard McCall. This has been Colombia Calling, episode one of 2016 and episode 124 in total. Continue to listen and continue to spread the good word. Thank you. Thank you to those 7,000 of you out there, plus 7,000 plus, who are continually downloading these episodes. And so I will sign off now from Mompox Bolivar out to the world. This is Colombia Calling. Bye-bye.